Good afternoon, you're listening to KFSK News for Wednesday, June 3rd. I'm Taylor Heckert. The Petersburg Borough Assembly unanimously approved several changes to the borough's finances at their meeting on Monday. That included passing the borough's annual budget, a 4% increase to electric rates, and a $3 increase to marine passenger fees. The budget for fiscal year 27 begins on July 1st. It includes spending just over $14 million from the general fund. Assemblymember Bob Martin said the budget wasn't an easy decision. He said residents aren't happy with the borough asking for more money to cover rising costs while residents' own costs are going up.
The rates are going up for utilities, the tax assessments have gone up, and we've got to admit that's part of the reason the budget's balanced.
Assemblymember Rob Schwartz agreed, saying he's also heard from concerned residents.
I'm getting an awful lot of input on this one. Yeah, we'll balance the budget, but we're going to increase everything. And I said it before, and I'll say it again, a lot of people are feeling the noose tighten.
Martin said he'd like the public to be more involved in the budget process next time, bringing more suggestions to the table.
We've had very little specific help from the public in going through this process. I'm going to vote yes. I hope I can do a better job next year, but I really need help with specific things that you're willing to cut.
The per passenger fee increase approved by the Assembly targets cruise ship visitors. The borough says the increase from $5 to $8 is needed to address the rising costs of services that are impacted by tourists, including public safety, harbor operations, sanitation, and emergency response. The 4% increase in Petersburg's electric rates applies to all customers across the board. It means that residential rates are going up from 12.2 cents per kilowatt hour to 12.7 cents. And the surcharge is rising by 64 cents. The borough requested the rate increase for Petersburg Municipal Power and Light to cover expenses and inflation. About a decade ago, humpback whale populations near Glacier Bay National Park plummeted amid a widespread marine heat wave. Ongoing research shows that recovery has begun, but a new report published this spring underscores that population growth has been slow. A longtime biologist in the park says that's due to lower reproduction rates and shifting ocean conditions. The Alaska guest, Avery Elfelt, has more.
It's one of Christine Gabriel's favorite times of the year. She's been a whale biologist in Glacier Bay National Park for nearly four decades. Each spring, she marvels as the humpbacks return after wintering overseas.
Seeing everybody come back, it's like taking attendance and seeing your old friends.
This year, she'll be keeping her eye out for two whales in particular, a male who would be returning for his 53rd year, and a female who Gabriel has monitored for decades but didn't return to the area last summer.
I hope that she's not gone for good, because she's one of my favorites.
Gabriel is part of a small team charged with studying the humpback population in Glacier Bay and Icy Strait. A major theme of their recent work has been studying how the whales are doing after a 2014 marine heat wave devastated marine environments up and down the West Coast, including the Gulf of Alaska. By 2018, the humpback population in Glacier Bay and Icy Strait had declined by more than 50%. That figure includes all of the calves born in 2014. Gabriel says they were never seen again. The heat wave also affected the whale's reproductive rate.
Instead of like one out of three females having a calf in a year, it was one out of 25.
That was back in 2019. Things have improved since then. On average, about one in 12 females has a calf each year. The research group released their 2025 update in April. Gabriel's takeaway is that the population seems to be recovering just very slowly. That's happening for a few reasons. Female whales seem to be waiting to reproduce until much later in life. They're also waiting 8 or 9 years between calves instead of 2 or 3. And the underlying marine environment is changing too. The whales seem to have a less reliable food supply, which Gabriel says probably explains why reproduction is happening less often.
The ocean is changing, and it's a tangled web to figure out exactly, what those sources are.
Answers could be coming. The Park Service is working on monitoring the forage fish population. Those are small, energy-rich fish like herring. Gabriel says the research will provide invaluable insight into the food supply, which affects seabirds, bears, whales, and Alaskans.
It's just one jump away from the salmon on my dinner plate to the krill and the fish that the whales are eating.
She says when the whales are doing well, Humans are, too. Reporting in Haines, I'm Avery Elfelt.
U.S. Senator Dan Sullivan and Representative Nick Begich are not saying how they feel about two of President Trump's most controversial priorities, a $1 billion security-related request for his ballroom and a nearly $1.8 billion compensation fund that could pay January 6th riot defendants and other Trump allies. Several news outlets reported Monday that Trump is reconsidering the compensation fund, which has sparked intense backlash. Still, Sullivan and Begich have stayed quiet. Alaska Public Media Washington correspondent Liz Ruskin reports.
Kodiak retiree Joan Sulesky says she was among a crowd of people who went to Double Shovel's Cider House in Kodiak for what was billed as a 6 p.m. meet and greet with Sullivan and Congressman Begich.
We all had jotted down our little questions to Dan, and, you know, we were waiting. Some people were actually telling us he's never going to show.
This was during the Island Town's Crab Fest. Sulesky says she planned to press Sullivan about Trump's anti-weaponization fund, which she describes as a corrupt money grab. Alaska's other Republican senator, Lisa Murkowski, calls it a slush fund. But after about 40 minutes with no members of Congress in sight, Sulesky says she and others gave up.
The overall feeling amongst everybody was, we didn't really think he was going to show, did you?
Since mid-May, Alaska Public Media has sent multiple emails asking for Sullivan's position on the fund and Trump's ballroom. Staff at Sullivan's Senate office and his campaign have not responded, and he did not grant interview requests for this story. Begich's office did not respond last week to an interview request or specific questions either. A Begich campaign spokesman said notice of the meet and greet was circulated before the congressman's travel schedule was finalized. The organizer, Republican Party local district chair Aaron Griffin, confirms that account. Sullivan's office did not say why he missed the Kodiak meet and greet on May 22. The Senate was released for the week the prior afternoon. Leaders of both the House and Senate scuttled votes that were expected to keep lawmakers in Washington longer. Alaskans critical of Trump often say they don't feel they have access to Sullivan or Begich. Begich's main opponents aren't giving him the benefit of the doubt.
Well, I think if you're going to serve Alaskans, you need to be out listening to Alaskans.
That's independent candidate Bill Hill. Another challenger, Democrat Matt Schultz, says he's not buying that there was no way for Begich to get to Kodiak for a 6 p.m. event after voting in Congress the evening prior.
If this was the first time that Nick Begich were completely inaccessible or ducked and covered from an important meeting, I'd think, all right, cut the guy some slack. But this is a pattern. It's an obvious pattern over and over and over again.
Hill and Schultz both appeared at the Kodiak Cider House for their own candidate meet and greets during Crab Fest. Schultz says appearing at the parade the next day, as Sullivan did, isn't an acceptable substitute.
Absolutely. It's not the same as a meet and greet where people have an opportunity to ask you questions or give you corrections. And then you have to stand there and listen and hear it and hopefully respond. If he's just walking down the street throwing candy, that is absolutely not the same.
Both Begich challengers are critical of the compensation fund and say spending taxpayer funds on the ballroom is a bad move. So does Sullivan's Democratic challenger Mary Peltola, who declined an interview request for this story. Sullivan and Begich have Trump's endorsement as they campaign. They rarely criticize the president's initiatives. And Trump doesn't give much wiggle room. He showed in lower 48 elections last month he'll work to defeat Republicans he deems insufficiently loyal. After not meeting nor greeting Sullivan at the Kodiak Cider House, Sulesky saw him walk in the Crab Fest parade the next morning.
We yelled out at him, "Where were you last night?" And he turned around, you know, and we said, hey, we waited for you, you know, and he just ran and just turned around and ran.
Sulesky says a gap had opened between Sullivan and his support car. He jogged ahead to keep up. Reporting from Anchorage, I'm Liz Ruskin.
Dozens and dozens of candidates officially kicked off their campaigns for governor, Congress, and the state legislature on Monday. A spokesperson for the Division of Elections says nearly 70 filings came in on Monday alone, which was the last day to register a campaign ahead of the August primary. Election officials were still sifting through them yesterday. In the days before the deadline, many incumbent state legislators did not have opponents. But now, after the surge of late entries, just six are unopposed. All six are either Democrats or coalition-aligned Republicans. Alaska Democratic Party Executive Director Jenny Marie Stryker says that's the result of a long-running effort to make as many races as possible competitive, even in districts that President Donald Trump won by 30 or 40 points.
It's important to contest races where a Democrat is a long shot because we have to demonstrate that inadequate leadership is not acceptable, that rolling over for Governor Dunleavy is not acceptable.
The most crowded fields are at the top of the ticket. 15 candidates are running for U.S. House, 16 for U.S. Senate, and 17 for governor. Brett Huber is a former aide to Governor Mike Dunleavy, who most recently ran the Alaska office of the conservative group Americans for Prosperity. And despite the crowded field of gubernatorial candidates, he says he's not excited about any of them. Huber says they're not telling Alaskans the truth about the problem the state faces.
Let's talk about the truth. State's out of money. We had a war, saved us. We have a $1.5 billion structural deficit in our budget. Who are we going to be when we grow up?
Huber says he'd like to see candidates spend more time talking about the most difficult issues the state faces, from education to public safety to the permanent dividend. Whether the candidates speak out more on those issues is yet to be seen, but they have plenty of time to do so. The primary election isn't until August 18th. For many communities in rural Alaska, accessing fresh fruit can be challenging. Most of it is shipped in from out of state and often loses flavor and more along the way. But a program in Metlakatla on Alaska's only native reservation is looking to change that. As KRBD's Hunter Morrison reports, it's one way the small village is trying to combat food insecurity.
Near Metlakatla's boat harbor, Gotgeta Hike, the village's community garden champion, strolls past a row of shrubs and small trees, which rustle with the wind. She points in the direction of two plants closest to the shoreline.
And then those two down on the end, I believe, are cherry.
And when were these ones planted?
These were planted last year.
The soon-to-be budding cherry trees were brought to the village as part of its community food forest project. That's an initiative that incorporates fruit-bearing trees and bushes into the village's public landscapes. So far, Hike says about 50 plants have taken root around town, from the city's ballpark to the boat harbor.
In like the next 3 years, we hope to be able to give fruit back to the community.
The program comes after Metlakatla's tribal council passed a resolution a few years back that required all beautification efforts in the community to be edible. Not long after, the village received a 3-year grant from the U.S. Forest Service to fund the project. The grant is currently in its final year, but Hike is looking for other funding. She says the project has primarily worked with apple trees, but they've also planted plum and nectarine trees. The initiative also deals with plants native to the region, like raspberries, gooseberries, and Saskatoon berries. Hike has even experimented with plants not usually grown in Southeast, like hazelnut trees, which she says seem to be doing well. And increasing access to fresh fruit is important because it's so limited in the village. There's just one grocery store on the island, and the majority of the produce comes from out of state.
I am hoping that the community utilizes this, and then it also inspires other communities to kind of do the same thing so that we don't have to rely on the lower 48 so heavily on our food.
While most of the program's trees and bushes are still young and not yet producing, Hike says she's educating the village about the project. Once the plants bloom, she says community members can harvest the fruit free of charge. All she asks is that it gets eaten.
It's astounding how much food gets wasted, and it's really a shame because that's a lot of energy that goes into that little piece of food from being plucked and then takes 2 weeks of a journey to get up here. It loses so much of its nutritional value.
To Hike's knowledge, there are no similar open harvest projects in Alaska. She hopes that Metlakatla's will eventually be self-sustaining and inspire community members to plant fruit trees of their own. Reporting in Metlakatla, I'm Hunter Morrison.
For KFSK, I'm Taylor Heckert.